Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, Zambians debate the nature and definition of witchcraft as two men go on trial accused of trying to kill the president by using the dark arts.
What has been called witchcraft is not even supposed to be called that, because this basically is knowledge, it is science, it is a practice, it is an expression, it is something that can be used, you know, to do good. But if someone actually chooses to do bad, then they're able to do that.
And how did Guinea manage to eradicate sleeping sickness as a public health risk? It's Monday, the 3rd of March. First, we go to South Africa. And we're going to start with a press briefing heard and seen around the world, in case you missed it.
You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards. I'm not playing cards.
Right now, you don't
have
cards. You're playing
cards.
You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people.
You're
gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
It took place in the U.S. seat of power, the White House, and it was between the American president, Donald Trump, and Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. People who saw it were aghast. Seasoned diplomats and commentators, ordinary viewers as well, were shocked at the language, the finger-pointing, the haranguing. Here's a reaction of a former U.S. diplomat, Brooke Spector, who is based in South Africa.
Every commentator, columnist, and person I've talked to shakes their head and says, I've never seen anything like that. One of the moments, the TV cameras cut away to the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, and she had her head in her hands, and the new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, looked absolutely ashen-faced.
We'll hear more from the retired American diplomat in just a moment, but let me fill you in on the rest of the story first. President Zelensky was in Washington to discuss a peace deal brokered by the U.S. between Ukraine and Russia involving rare earth minerals for peace. Following that very public argument, European nations rallied around the Ukrainian president, offering him both moral and material support. They also came up with ideas as to how he could go back to the U.S. to continue talks to end the war with Russia. In all of this, we've been wondering where that leaves South Africa's offer to act as a broker between Russia and Ukraine, because South Africa has its own diplomatic difficulties with the U.S. at the moment. Things like accusations that South Africa is executing a genocide against its white population. So what would a meeting between South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa and U.S. President Donald Trump be like? Here's Brooks Spector again.
Well, they're not going to see eye to eye on a number of things. That's also true. But Cyril Ramaphosa does have his diplomatic side. He seems to have been born to the idea of mediating and reaching out rather than, you know, raising his fists. If he and Donald Trump were to engage in a private conversation, I would think, I'm guessing here because it hasn't happened yet, but I would think that by the time they ended up in front of the cameras in the Oval Office, they would have agreed in a politer kind of way on points where they disagreed as well as those areas where they did agree. It would look like a conversation between adults. That is, unless Donald Trump chose not to make it that kind of thing.
Let's talk about the effects of the meeting and what people saw on screen between Mr. Zelensky, J.D. Vance, and President Donald Trump. What it seemed to do was it rallied European countries into coming up with more money, more arms, more proposals around how to bring an end to the war in Ukraine. But South Africa has offered to mediate. Where does that leave the South African initiative and the visit of President Zelensky to South Africa?
There have been, over the last couple of years, obviously, some efforts by the South African president to serve as an honest broker, to bring along a collection of other African leaders. And that may have been too early. And in some ways, because South Africa was seen as too closely aligned with Russia, it was probably not going to be a successful effort. And it turns out it was not. But you will notice that in the most recent UN resolution vote, the South Africans voted with a majority of nations, and the United States voted against it, together with countries like Belarus and North Korea.
And Russia.
Obviously Russia, of course, because they were the named culprit.
Well, the reason why I'm mentioning it is because the U.S. and Russia almost never vote in the same way at the United Nations. So I just thought I'd lift that out for the benefit of our listeners.
It was fascinating to watch as South Africa and a number of other countries moved into a position of specifically and explicitly stating Russia was the aggressor and that should cease.
So would you say that peace initiative has been blown out of the water with the stiffened European resolve? I mean, is there any point in the visit continuing?
Actually, I think there is, because I do think that initiatives like a meeting between the heads of Ukraine and South Africa should go forward, precisely because the international landscape with regard to the conflict in Ukraine has changed. The American position has changed. The European position has changed. The UN's circumstances seem to have changed. And this gives an opening. This gives an opportunity for countries like South Africa to begin to find some sort of niche where they can insert their influence and their action. All such things are helpful in this regard to ending a conflict like this.
South Africa's relationship with Russia is also in an interesting place at the moment, isn't it? They're allies in BRICS, but South Africa, as you were just saying, voted for a UN resolution which condemns Russia as the aggressor in the war. Pretoria is caught in quite a weird pincer position at the moment. Just spell out some of the implications that you can see arising from this. You know, it's difficulties with America at the moment, it's allied position with Russia, but at the same time, it's voted against Russia. Does this have long-term effects? And also perhaps South Africa being seen as allied with other Western nations, a position that it hasn't enjoyed in the last few years concerning Ukraine and concerning the ICJ and the case against Israel.
Let's start with this. The United States and South Africa have had a disagreement that's fairly significant, obviously, over the way the South Africans went to the International Court of Justice over Israeli actions in Gaza. And the United States has been, as a country, as a government, obviously, has been very unhappy with that. Some members of the American Congress, mostly Republicans, have seen that as part of a larger picture of the way South Africa has positioned close relations with Russia, with China, with Iran. And that in turn has led to efforts to get changes in the American-South African relationship, notably whether or not South Africa should or can remain a beneficiary of duty-free entry into the American market under the terms of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, as well as the aid program that the United States has funded. But I like to remind people that the relationship between the United States and South Africa is not simply one of government-to-government relations. There are something on the order of 600 American companies that are invested in South Africa, either as direct investments or through franchises or subsidiaries. This is not empty portfolio investment. This is bricks and mortar stuff.
That's Brooks Spector, a retired American diplomat who's been living in South Africa for several decades now. We're in Zambia next, where two men are on trial for witchcraft. They're accused of possessing charms intending to harm President Hakainde Hichilema. The trial has sparked an intense conversation about witchcraft, which strikes at the heart of how Zambia defines itself, a Christian nation. It says it right there in the Constitution. Like so many other countries, there are strong beliefs in magic and supernatural phenomena. In former colonial countries, there are laws still on the books that criminalize locally rooted beliefs. Professor Gankanani Moyo takes issue with this. He is a cultural heritage lecturer at the University of Zambia. We had a fascinating conversation about what is considered witchcraft and where it sits in a country that considers itself to be a Christian nation.
I personally have problems even with the term itself, witchcraft, because witchcraft is an English term. So sometimes people have ubuloshi or umfiti. So generally when you use English and you talk about witchcraft, in Zambia it is interpreted as this science or some spiritual energy, that which is used to hate other people. So it is looked at as a practice that is purely negative, and those that are very spiritual use the word evil to mean something negative, something bad, a practice that does not help humanity.
Is there another side to what people would consider to be witchcraft? Is there another side that implies doing good, expressing blessings on somebody rather than curses?
Witchcraft itself has that negative term, but what has been called witchcraft is not even supposed to be called that, because this basically is knowledge, it is science, it is a practice, it is an expression. It is something that can be used, you know, to do good. But if someone actually chooses to do bad, then they're able to do that. We've given an example of any other science. For instance, the science that created the atomic bomb that kills beings, is the same science actually that is used to discover medicines. And the so-called witchcraft is actually basically a science. It is a knowledge that we have.
When did the separation between witchcraft and healing happen? Is it a continuum that you're talking about?
It's quite strange. Much earlier, there was a case where people felt that there is a difference between a witchcraft practitioner and a healer. There's a healer, there is a herbalist, there is a diviner. So there are all these areas. But I think with time, people, after being exposed to, I would say, Western civilization or Western knowledge, everything I think that is associated with our knowledge has been presented in negative light. So our interaction with Western societies is what actually has hurt us this much as Africans. We've been made to believe that our knowledge does not have value, and it is not a knowledge that we should use for progress as a people. Instead, we have to look to the West for knowledge, Christianity in particular. Christianity preaches almost against everything that is traditionally African. So if you are an African, then you are evil. And we have a country like
Zambia. You mean
Zambia.
If you hold that traditional healing is valuable and worthwhile, then that is seen as a belief that is unchristian.
Right? That's unchristian.
Right. So it was also penalized, because there's legislation from the colonial era that actually criminalized holding such beliefs, right? And that brings us to what we're talking about today, a case in Zambia about two men that are facing charges for wanting to harm the president by practicing witchcraft and possessing charms. Has there ever been a case like this before in Zambia?
I don't remember a time when there's been a case like this. And I think that's why this case has really been in the news, because it's quite new that there are people who have planned to attack a president.
So who brought the case, and what's the evidence that they're bringing?
Well, the case was brought by the state, because it's the state that discovered these individuals at a lodge within Lusaka, and they had a live chameleon and all sorts of charms. And upon interrogation, they confessed that they had been hired to curse the president so that he dies. And yes, the law that is being used is the Witchcraft Act, which criminalizes any knowledge of witchcraft.
How long has that law been on the books?
Well, it's been on the books, I think, since sometime in 1912. It's been revised over time. This is a law that was drafted by the colonial government, and the colonial government did not take into account our beliefs as a people. But sadly, almost everything else that is built on our current generations actually comes from the colonial systems, the colonial era. We have failed as a people to revisit our lives, to renew our perspectives, so that we are able to have our own identities within our spaces.
Why do you think that's the case? Has it something to do with the fact that Zambia considered itself, and actually had this enshrined in the constitution, that it is a Christian nation?
Christianity to me is the major culprit, because it has been put in front of everything else. And it's not just against our traditional practices, but it basically is against all other religions. Why do I say so? Because the constitution says that Zambia is a Christian nation. However, people are free to practice their spirituality. But you will agree with me that the moment you just say it is a Christian nation, it means everything else that comes in does not have the power of Christianity. It therefore cannot match up to Christianity. And it's for this reason that everything has to conform to Christianity in the country.
What I'm wanting us to address is the fact, though, that Christianity is a set of beliefs that is perpetrated or is practiced by people, whether they're in power or not. So the people in power in Zambia had the opportunity to change that. They didn't. What I'm wondering is why not?
If you check the statistics, you will learn that about 95% of the population in Zambia professes to be Christian. Now, this is very interesting because when you talk to individuals, you find that the majority who profess to be Christian do not even believe in Christianity. However, it's important to have this clause in the Constitution because it also benefits politicians. So politicians that are able to present themselves as Christians can easily be voted into office. So because of that, and you know the power that politicians have, it's very difficult to revisit that. People have fear of challenging the dominant narratives in almost every space. They will actually enact their practices, usually in private, because they know that if they do it publicly, then they're likely to face negative consequences.
Or criminal charges. Let's take a look at what the charges entail and what the punishment could be, and also people's reaction to what's going on. They're alleged to have had several things and totems in their possession. They confess to wanting to harm the president. And have they appeared in court yet?
Yes, they have appeared in court. I haven't followed the proceedings very closely because initially it was agreed that the case would be televised so that people can follow. But then later, the church advised against it. They thought that we would be giving maybe power to the so-called witchcraft. And that's how it was said that it wouldn't be televised.
As is the way in many things in the world today, younger people are questioning received wisdoms. I'm just wondering whether in Zambia at the moment there are people who are saying, younger people especially, who are saying, well, actually, we want to draw closer to our traditional beliefs. We believe that this is a more truer expression of ourselves and are looking to reject the notion that Zambia is a Christian nation to the exclusion of others.
Yes, well, you know, very recently, a lot of young people seemed to be becoming aware of the fact that their identity is questioned. They are unable to say who they really are. And it's for this reason that they think that a lot of steps, you know, have to be taken in order to address their issue of identity. And then as much as they talk about this, it's very difficult, again, for young people to publicly challenge the fact that Zambia is a Christian nation. This is because they've been taught that if you challenge Christianity, then you are challenging God himself. And you know the position that God has been given in people's lives. It's like he's everything, he's central to everything. So if you challenge God, then you are challenging your own existence. So that also becomes a challenge. But I cannot run away from the fact that I have observed that, you know, there are young people who are able to question these narratives, who think that there is a lot of truth in our heritage, not just because it is our heritage, but it is what has defined us over the years. It has been lost, but it's something that can be regained. The only challenge is the form.
Professor Gankanani Moyo from the University of Zambia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Guinea has achieved a major public success in public health by eliminating human African trypanosomiasis, or sleeping sickness. The illness is classified as a neglected tropical disease which affects 24 countries in Africa and occurs in other parts of the world as well. It is also the first of its kind to be eliminated in Guinea. It is spread by infected flies and has been difficult to tackle, especially in remote areas. If untreated, it can cause severe damage to the central nervous system. Dr. Wilfred Mutombo is part of the team that eliminated the sickness in Guinea.
In Guinea, like in many countries affected by sleeping sickness, so they have control program. And the control program is work in partnership with some institution. And the control program was working on two fields. So control of patients, so with mobile team going from a village to another village, screening old people, and among which they were diagnosing people. That is the first activity. And the second one, very important too, was the vector control, because Guinea was very, very, very strong. Even now they are very strong in these vector control activities, and they were using many kind of devices, and the most famous is the Tiny Target. So those two activities put together were very active on this with support of their partner.
That's Dr. Wilfred Mutombo. Duncan Ochol is a senior director of programs for the End Neglected Diseases Fund. He told us a bit more about sleeping sickness and how other countries can achieve what Guinea did to eliminate the illness.
Sleeping sickness, which is also known as human African trypanosomiasis, is a parasitic disease, but it's caused by a parasite known as trypanosoma, and it is transmitted by the tsetse fly. There are two types of sleeping sickness or human African trypanosomiasis. We have the acute type, which is normally found within East and Southern Africa. And then we have the chronic type, which is the most common, and it is found in Central and West Africa.
So does it only happen in African countries?
Yes, human African trypanosomiasis only happens in African countries. But trypanosomiasis in general, you have in Africa, and you have another one that is found in South America, but caused by a totally different parasite, and is spread by a different organism. It's not spread by the tsetse fly.
Right. So tell me this. Why is it dangerous, and why did it need to be eliminated? Because there are lots of diseases that we don't think need to be eliminated. They're just diseases that we try and deal with and treat.
Yes. First, sleeping sickness or human African trypanosomiasis is one of the diseases that has been classified by the World Health Organization as a neglected tropical disease, simply because there is very little research that has been done on them. The drugs that are used for treatment were developed very many years ago. It affects mostly the poor and the marginalized community in remote areas. But this one specifically is a disease that is 100% fatal if it is not treated. It kills. And after transmission, it goes through several stages. The late stage of the disease, it affects the central nervous system, which means that it affects the brain and all the areas surrounding the brain. So there is a confusion, there is a loss of coordination, you cannot work, and then obviously the alteration of the sleep disturbance, and that is where it gets the disease from.
How does one know that you have it?
One, it is transmitted by the tsetse fly. So once you are bitten by the tsetse fly, it progresses into two stages. The first stage, which is called the early stage, you develop a fever, headache, joint pains, and there's some swelling on the lymph nodes when it is still in the blood and the lymphatic system. So that is the early stage. Then the second, it progresses now to what it gets into the central nervous system that now causes confusion, there's a lack of coordination, and then the sleep disturbances.
The initial symptoms sound to be like the symptoms of many other illnesses. They sort of flu-like. When will one know that it's serious? When will you need to go for medical attention?
The first symptoms is common, like flu symptoms, malaria symptoms. If you live in an area that is known to be endemic, for example, if you live on the coastal region of Western Africa where you have the disease, there are places that is endemic because it is so focal, or in places where it is. So it is one of the diseases that needs to be tested. So what you do is that once you go for clinical examination, you have those symptoms, then the next thing is to do a test, a laboratory test, for you to know whether you're having the sleeping sickness or not.
Are those tests easily available? Because you've been involved in trying to fight this illness since the turn of the century. Has treatment and also spotting it, you know, surveillance of it, got better over the years?
There has been some progress. Initially, I started working on sleeping sickness in late 90s and early 2000. So during that time, it was very difficult to diagnose. And that is why patients were coming in very late, like mostly in the second stage of the disease. So when you come in the second stage, it is quite late. Yeah, because you already develop neurological symptoms, and some of them are permanent even if you get treated. So it was not very easy. Nowadays, there has been some progress on testing, because there has been some rapid diagnostic tests that can be found in peripheral hospitals and health facilities. But then it is something that has to be diagnosed within the health facility system. You cannot diagnose it in the community.
It's called human African trypanosomiasis and or sleeping sickness. What is the sleeping sickness? Does it make you sleep too much or does it make you not sleep? What is it?
Yeah, that is alteration of the sleeping pattern. Most of the time, people tend to be somnolent. They're most sleepy during the day and they cannot work. We can't call them lazy, but then that was what was being used before. So it alters the waking-sleeping cycle. And then the duration of sleep also reduces. So sleeping, you can sleep maybe for 3-4 hours only, maybe at night, but then most of the people sleep during the day.
It does seem to take a very long time. Just remind me how it spread. You said a fly bites one human, that human gets infected, the fly bites another. So it's directly from fly to fly. It's not person to person. I mean, one person having it isn't able to infect another. Or am I misunderstanding something?
A fly has to bite. Then the tsetse fly gets infected. There's a development stage in the tsetse fly. And then when it bites the next person, it can spread. So the tsetse fly has to be there. That is why for the control, you also have to deal with the tsetse fly.
Oh, say the fly bites me. Then the fly gets infected. Am I infecting the fly?
Yes, the human infects the fly. And then the fly will develop in the fly and then it infects the next person.
No, so but where did I get it from? Because I thought that the tsetse fly bites me and the tsetse fly gives it to me.
There are two things. If the tsetse fly is infected, if it bites you, it will give it to you. But then for it to move from you to the next person, you also have to infect the tsetse fly. So by the time the tsetse fly is taking a blood meal, it is injecting. And then when you take it to the parasite into your blood system, it is spreading it to you. But then if it doesn't have, it is taking from you and then it will develop and then it will infect the next person.
Right. So it's an infected tsetse fly that infects another human being who may very well.
Yes.
Okay. How many people would you say have died in the last 22 years?
More than 20,000 people have died. But in general, what happened is that disease is also prone to outbreaks. Initially, before the 1970s and 60s and 70s, there was a concerted effort on control. And then the number of cases reduced drastically from more than 100,000 to less than 30,000. And then late 80s and early 90s, then the control programs did not work very well. The problem with success, because people felt that now we have controlled the disease, now there is no problem. So they disease started spreading again. So from there have been those episodes of very high cases of deaths. Currently, the number of cases have drastically reduced. I think there are less than 10,000 cases worldwide.
So what do you think the 23 other countries in Africa that still have the illness, what can they learn from what Guinea did?
What has happened is this is an elimination as a public health problem. The disease is still there, but at very low level that does not cause any public health problem. So what you do next is to continue with surveillance. What do the other countries need to do? One, they learn from Egypt. There must be political will to make sure that now this disease becomes a public health issue. Then we have to do the control measures that are required. And identify the cases early. Once you identify them early, you reduce the transmission. The other is vector control. You need to control the vector, which is the tsetse fly. And then they need to improve on surveillance. So making sure that all the countries understand these are the symptoms, and then they record all the cases, they bring them for treatment. The aim of WHO at the end is to have zero cases by 2030. Then we'll be sure, much safer.
That's Duncan Ochol from the End Neglected Diseases Fund. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Twagira-Maria, Bella Hassan, and Nyasha Michelle. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Francesca Dunn, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Alan Kasuja and the Africa Daily team are taking a look at how artificial intelligence is changing the world and how Africa can get in on influencing those inevitable changes to create a truly African AI. He'll be discussing it with Ambassador Philip Thigo, Kenya's special envoy on technology. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.